Welcome to Hub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 39, Tragedy at Coconut Grove. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to discuss the 1942 fire at the Coconut Grove nightclub. 492 people were killed in the blaze, making it the deadliest fire in Boston history. It's also the deadliest modern disaster of any type in Boston. Only the smallpox epidemics of the early 1700s and the 1918 Spanish flu rival it for loss of life. But before we talk about the tragedy at Coconut Grove, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is July 31st. The SS Iberian was a 437-foot cargo ship capable of carrying over 5,200 tons. She had left Boston Harbor on July 7, 1915, bound for Manchester, England. After a quick turnaround, she sailed for Boston again. Those were the early days of World War I, and German submarines were hunting for British shipping. On the afternoon of July 31st, U-28 spotted the Iberian off the southwestern coast of Ireland. Captain Lieutenant Freiherr Georg Günther von Forstner, commander of the U-boat, recorded what happened next in the ship's log. Our U-28 torpedoed the British steamer Iberian, which was carrying a rich cargo across the North Atlantic. The steamer sank so swiftly that its bow stuck up almost vertically into the air. Moments later, the hull of the Iberian disappeared. The wreckage remained beneath the water for approximately 25 seconds at a depth that was clearly impossible to assess, when suddenly there was a violent explosion which shot pieces of debris, among them a giant aquatic animal, out of the water to a height of approximately 80 feet. At that moment, I had with me in the conning tower six of my officers of the watch, including the chief engineer, the navigator, and the helmsman. Simultaneously, we all drew one another's attention to this wonder of the seas, which was writhing and struggling among the debris. We were unable to identify the creature, but all of us agreed that it resembled an aquatic crocodile, which was about 60 feet long, with four limbs resembling large webbed feet, a long pointed tail, and a head which also tapered to a point. Unfortunately, we were not able to take a photograph, for the animal sank out of sight after 10 or 15 seconds. If there was anybody in the tower named Jay, it might have sounded a little bit like this.
Will you look at this thing we got? Holy s***, people, will you look at this fish that me and Jay Foster got right here, kid? Oh my God, kid. We have a whale here, bro. Holy s***. This is nuts. Jay, what are we going to do here, kid? Oh my God, bro, look at this thing.
Believers cite this as irrefutable evidence of the existence of sea serpents, perhaps descendants of a prehistoric crocodile lurking in the briny deep. Personally, it's one of my very favorite pieces of Boston historical trivia.
If we told you that 5,000 people gathered at Faneuil Hall in a rally supporting free love on August 1st, what year would you have guessed it happened in? Perhaps you'd guess the 1967 Summer of Love. You'd only be a little bit off. It's actually 1878. Ezra and Angela Haywood were radicals. They had advocated for abolition before the Civil War, believed in extreme personal liberty, and worked for suffrage. Their personal heroes were Jesus Christ and abolitionist John Brown. By the 1870s, they were radical feminists who had published a pamphlet called Cupid's Yokes, or The Binding Forces of Conjugal Life, an essay to consider some moral and physiological phases of love and marriage, wherein is asserted the natural right and necessity of sexual self-government. That's a long title, so we'll just call it Cupid's Yokes. It argued that the institution of marriage subjected women to sexual slavery in return for economic status. It frankly discusses abortion and birth control, and states that people should be free to make their own sexual choices. If government cannot justly determine what ticket we shall vote, what church we shall attend, or what books we shall read, by what authority does it watch at keyholes and burst open bedchamber doors to drag lovers from sacred seclusion? Why should priests and magistrates supervise the sexual organs of citizens any more than the brain or the stomach? If unwedded lovers who cohabitate are lewd, will paying a marriage fee to a minister make them virtuous? Sexual organs are not less sacredly the property of individual citizens than other bodily organs. This being undeniable, Who but the individual owners can rightly determine when, where, how, and for what purpose they shall be used?
Well, that aged well.
On June 25th, 1878, Ezra was convicted of indecency for sending Cupid's yokes through the U.S. mail and sentenced to 2 years at hard labor in Dedham Jail. On August 1st, thousands of sympathizers gathered in Boston, demanding respect for the couple's free speech rights. Ezra would be pardoned by President Rutherford B. Hayes, but he was arrested 5 more times as a result of his activism, eventually serving 2 years in Charlestown Penitentiary for distributing sex ed material. Despite her equal partnership in writing and publishing these materials, Angela was never arrested. That is some sexist bullfeathers.
Wednesday is August 2nd. In the early morning hours of August 2nd, 1943, a group of 15 small U.S. Navy patrol boats loitered in the Blackett Strait in the Solomon Islands. These small craft were armed with torpedoes and depth charges. They were searching for opportunities to intercept the Japanese ships that were bringing supplies to nearby troops. One of these boats was PT-109, an 80-foot-long boat with a wooden hull, powerful engines, and a crew of 13 men. She was commanded by a 26-year-old lieutenant junior grade from Brookline, Massachusetts. At around 2 a.m., the Japanese destroyer Amagiri suddenly emerged from the fog, traveling at high speeds in order to run the gauntlet of American ships. The young officer ordered his crew to spin up the engines and tried to turn the patrol boat to fire. However, in less than 10 seconds, the destroyer collided with the much smaller boat, running over it, cutting it in half, and setting it on fire. 2 members of the crew were killed in the collision, and 2 more were seriously injured. The crew of the Japanese ship may not have ever seen them in the water. The survivors from PT-109 gathered around the wreckage of their boat as it drifted through the straits that were patrolled not only by Japanese warships, but also by sharks and saltwater crocodiles. Their commander put the question of whether to attempt an escape or surrender to a vote, saying, "There's nothing in the book about a situation like this. A lot of you men have families, and some of you have children. What do you want to do? I have nothing to lose." They chose to try to evade capture. All the survivors were exhausted, several were sick from breathing toxic fumes and swallowing gasoline after the collision, 1 was badly burned, and the lieutenant had injured his lower back. Nevertheless, they decided that they would swim for a small island over 3 miles away, as all the closer, larger islands were occupied by Japanese soldiers. The lieutenant took a strap from the badly burned engineer's life jacket in his teeth and towed him as he swam. Just as a side note, I go to the YMCA and swim 1 mile once or twice a week. Swimming 1 mile in a climate-controlled pool is hard. I can't imagine swimming 3 miles in the dark with an injured back while pulling another human with my teeth through waters full of crocodiles, sharks, and enemy sailors. In the coming days, the officer would swim untold miles, island to island, searching for supplies and a way to make contact with friendly forces. Finally, the survivors encountered 2 islanders who worked as coast watchers for the Allies. The islanders showed the crew how to scratch a message into a green coconut husk, then they carried that message by canoe to an Allied base 40 miles away, risking death and torture if they had been captured by the Japanese. Finally, on August 7th, the crew was rescued. For his courage and leadership, the young lieutenant junior grade was awarded the Navy and Marine Corps Medal, the highest honor for life-saving. The citation read, "For extremely heroic conduct as commanding officer of Motor Torpedo Boat 109, following the collision and sinking of that vessel in the Pacific War area on August 2, 1943. Unmindful of personal danger, Lieutenant John Fitzgerald Kennedy unhesitatingly braved the difficulties and hazards of darkness to direct rescue operations, swimming many hours to secure aid and food after he had succeeded in getting his crew ashore. His outstanding courage, endurance, and leadership contributed to the saving of several lives and were in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service."
From one early morning date with destiny by a Massachusetts president to another. Calvin Coolidge was elected as vice president on the ticket with Warren G. Harding in the 1920 presidential election. He had been the governor of Massachusetts until his aggressive response to the 1919 Boston police strike propelled him to national prominence. You can learn more about that story in our episode 28, which is all about the police strike. In early August 1923, Silent Cal was on vacation at his family's home in rural Vermont. The old farmhouse had no electricity or telephone. President Harding died suddenly and unexpectedly on August 2nd, But the vice president went to bed before receiving the news. Finally, a messenger arrived at the house in the middle of the night. Coolidge dressed and came downstairs to greet the reporters and dignitaries who were gathering. At 2:47 a.m. on August 3, 1923, his father John, a notary public and justice of the peace, administered the oath of office to President Calvin Coolidge by the light of a kerosene lamp. Our current president seems slightly insecure about attendance at his inauguration, but he can be confident that his crowds were larger than at least one president. As the UPI wire service put it at the time, other presidents have taken the oath on a rostrum before the Capitol at Washington, with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court administering it, with troops drawn up, with bands and flags and vast cheering crowds of witnesses. Calvin Coolidge was inaugurated in a small room just across the road from the house where he was born, hours before dawn, with his father, unshaven and collarless, handing him the well-thumbed family Bible, in the presence of his wife, Jim McErney, a chauffeur, Congressman Porter H. Dale, L.L. Lane, president of the Railway Mail Association of New England, and Secretary Geiser of his Washington office. After taking the oath, Coolidge dictated a telegram of condolence to Florence Harding, issued a reassuring statement to the American people, and went back to bed.
Friday is August 4th. The early Republic was a period in which political passions ran high and sometimes turned violent. In 1804, Vice President Aaron Burr, a Democratic Republican, shot and killed Federalist Alexander Hamilton in a duel that seems to have been nearly forgotten by history, especially these past few years. Closer to home, a Boston Democrat named William Austin and a Boston Federalist named James Elliott got so mad at one another that they traveled to Rhode Island to fight a duel under Rhode Island's more permissive laws. They traded pistol shots at dawn on March 31st, 1806. Both men survived, though Mr. Austin was wounded in the thigh and neck. That same summer, political violence came to the streets of Boston. Benjamin Austin was chairman of the local Democratic-Republican Party and a cousin of William Austin. He threw a huge celebration for Independence Day. After it was over, he ended up getting into a dispute over the bill with his caterer. The caterer, in turn, hired attorney Thomas Selfridge, a Federalist, to try to collect the bill. Selfridge and Austin began trading public insults in the local newspapers and continued even after the catering bill was settled. As Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote of another dispute of that era,
"Not to crack under the stress, we're breaking down like fractions. We smack each other in the press and we don't print retractions."
The straw that broke the camel's back was an ad that Selfridge published in the Boston Gazette that said, "Benjamin Austin, loan officer, having acknowledged that he has circulated an infamous falsehood concerning my professional conduct in a certain cause, and having refused to give the satisfaction due to a gentleman in similar cases, I hereby publish said Austin as a coward, a liar, and a scoundrel. And if said Austin has the effrontery to deny any part of the charge, he shall be silenced by the most irrefragable proofs." On August 4, 1806, Thomas Selfridge was working in his office at the old State House when his friend Henry Cabot came in. Cabot had heard a rumor that Austin hired someone to give Selfridge a public beating. Enraged, Selfridge armed himself with a brace of pistols and stormed out into State Street. In an area called the Public Exchange, Benjamin's 18-year-old son, Charles Austin, confronted Selfridge with a heavy cane. What happened next is subject to debate. Some accounts say that young Charles gave Selfridge a blow to the forehead with his hickory cane. Others say that only words were exchanged. No matter the truth, the outcome would be the same. Selfridge fired one of the pistols he was carrying, and Charles Austin fell dead on State Street. Selfridge went on trial in December. In his instructions to the jury before they deliberated, Chief Justice Theophilus Parsons gave lengthy guidance on the evidence that had been presented and on the legal differences between murder and manslaughter. He also laid the groundwork for the legal concept of justifiable homicide in an act of self-defense. A man may repel force by force in defense of his person against anyone who manifestly intends to kill him, and if he kills him in so doing, it is justifiable self-defense. But a bare fear unaccompanied by an open act indicative of such an intention will not warrant him in killing. There must be an actual danger at the time, otherwise the killing of the assailant will not be justifiable homicide. The jury found Thomas Selfridge not guilty, though it's not clear whether they were convinced by the evidence that Austin had struck him, or if they were sympathetic to the public insult that he had suffered.
After 3 years of brutal war on the northern frontier, a group of Penobscot warriors, accompanied by their leader Wenamowit, went into Falmouth, Massachusetts, which we know today as Portland, Maine. It was July 29th, 1725, and Massachusetts Governor William Dummer was waiting for them. They presented the governor with letters of intent and wampum belts to indicate their willingness to discuss peace. On August 5th, Wenamowit and Dummer ratified a peace treaty that would begin to wind down the conflict known alternately as Father Rail's War, Dummer's War, or Greylock's War. Though the Penobscot people of Maine laid down their arms, the war wasn't over yet. The Mi'kmaq and Maliseet tribes of Nova Scotia signed a treaty the following summer, and the Wabanaki Band, led by Greylock, kept fighting until 1727 and never signed a peace treaty.
Finally, Sunday is August 6th, and on August 6th, 1776, John Adams weighed in on his family's ongoing recovery from the smallpox inoculation, which was entering its second month. John Quincy's inoculation had been immediately successful. He got a mild case of the pox to build his antibodies. Much of the rest of the family had to be re-inoculated. Nabby, Charles, and Tommy will have the smallpox well, I don't doubt. Tell John he is a very lucky young gentleman to have it so much better than his mama, his sister, and brothers. After initially receiving the inoculation on July 12th, the family would spend 7 weeks recuperating, and little Charlie almost didn't make it. For more on inoculation, check out our second episode. With that, it's time to turn to the most tragic single day in Boston's history.
In November of 1942, Boston was a city on wartime footing. The Boston Harbor Islands bristled with artillery, and the harbor itself was filled with underwater mines and submarine nets. Germany had declared war on the U.S. a year earlier, just days after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Throughout the summer and fall of 1942, German U-boats dominated the waters off Massachusetts, sinking over 500 ships. At the peak, they sank one ship every 4 hours, sometimes within sight of the Boston skyline. The mines and nets were meant to deter the German submarines, and a blackout that summer was meant to prevent ships from being silhouetted against the bright coast in the crosshairs of a periscope. As the holidays approached, it was a bittersweet season. Many families had fathers, sons, and brothers serving far away in the Atlantic or Pacific theaters. Gas and heating oil were being rationed for civilian use, and ration coupon books controlled the supply of household staples. Stores couldn't put up their usual elaborate window displays for holiday shoppers, and lighted public trees and window candles were strictly forbidden due to the blackout. Civil defense posters hung in the streets, reminding citizens about the potential for air raids, saying, "This war is not like any other. It may reach your street, your home, at any moment. You may be fighting in this war tomorrow, or next week, or next month. Your government asks of you one simple thing, but one very important thing. Learn and remember what to do if enemy planes and bombs come." They tell you what to do if you're at home when enemy planes come, or at school, or in a car, and they warn, critically, not to take shelter in Boston's subway tunnels, as they are not safe from bombs. Ironically, the national crisis meant that Boston, like many industrial cities around the country, was booming. Factories in the city and suburbs were cranking out materials for the war, while Hingham produced thousands of tons of ammunition and bombs for the Allies. Shipyards in Charlestown, South Boston, Quincy, and Hingham built new ships for the U.S. Navy and Allies faster than German U-boats could sink them.
It may have been a somber time in the country, but young people are the same in any era. The city was full of young sailors and soldiers, as well as factory workers, including young women who now had their own independent incomes to spend. They were looking for drinking, dancing, and a brief escape from the grim reality of wartime. They could find that escape in Boston's nightclubs, many of which were located in Roxbury in the South End. You had the Savoy Cafe, the Hi-Hat, the Roseland Ballroom, where a young Malcolm X worked shining shoes, the Cotton Club, and, of course, the Coconut Grove. As one article described it, in the early 40s, the Coconut Grove was the brightest star in the firmament of Boston nightclubs. The Grove was located in a former factory and parking garage between Broadway, Piedmont, and Tremont Streets, near the Theater District and just steps from Park Square. The club had been opened in 1927 by two local big band leaders, Mickey Alpert and Jacques Renard. They weren't able to make it profitable, and soon Charles King Solomon, leader of Boston's Jewish organized crime syndicate, stepped in to provide financing. He took over ownership of the club in 1931, and it was soon profitable. On paper, at least. Solomon slashed costs dramatically by bringing in underpaid teenage staff, performing shoddy repairs on the building, and by cracking down on the old dine-and-dash by bricking up some exits and bolting others closed. However, it's hard to tell how much of the club's newfound success was due to these measures, and how much was because Boston Charlie was using the club to launder money from his vast criminal enterprise. In 1933, King Solomon was shot and killed in the nearby Cotton Club, which he also owned. At that point, ownership of the Coconut Grove fell to one of his attorneys, Barney Wolanski, who took over just as Prohibition was ending. According to the Coconut Grove Coalition, Wolanski brought in Reuben Bodenhorn, a prominent Boston interior designer, to redesign the interior to make the club more family-oriented. It was Bodenhorn who brought in the tropical theme, with artificial palm trees, blue satin ceilings, dance floor, bandstand, and rolling platform stage. Above was a retractable roof for warm, starlit nights. Island-themed decorations installed in the Melody Lounge, the Caricature Bar, and the main dining room included blue satin cloth applied to the ceilings and walls, with airspace between the cloth and wooden furring underneath. The trunks of artificial palm trees were wrapped with loose vegetable fiber, and the palm branches reached nearly to the ceiling. The trees, of course, were equipped with electric lights.
A Boston Globe retrospective describes what an arriving clubgoer would have seen in November of 1942. Passing through revolving doors of the main entrance on Piedmont Street, one came into a beautiful foyer with deep plush carpeting. Beyond this and to the right was the swank main dining room with its seven large, realistically exotic artificial palm trees flanking the dance floor. Facing the dining room was the spacious Caricature Bar, boasting the longest counter in Boston. The new lounge at the Broadway side of the club was a popular retreat for businessmen and the latest structural addition. Just below the revolving doors on Piedmont Street was a basement bar called the Melody Lounge. While this might sound straightforward, in reality, the club was a confusing warren of bars, coat checks, storage closets, dressing rooms, kitchens, and stairwells, with one of the levels located underground. The establishment had a posted capacity of 460 people. But on the night of November 28th, there were almost 1,000 people packed into the many available dining rooms and bars. It was Thanksgiving weekend, and people were ready to celebrate, despite the wartime atmosphere. At the time, there was a heated football rivalry between Holy Cross and Boston College, and they played each other that day at Fenway Park. Holy Cross won in a surprise upset, so some sports fans were looking to drown their sorrows. And to top it all off, the new lounge on Broadway had opened just a week before, and patrons were eager to check it out. Just after 10 that evening, the house band was about to go on stage in the main dining room. Coincidentally, the band leader that night was Mickey Alpert, one of the original owners of the club. Downstairs in the Melody Lounge, the atmosphere was intimate. Low wattage bulbs peeked out between the palm fronds and rattan wrappings, barely providing enough light to see. A young woman named Gorizia Goodell, who went by the stage name Goody, was playing piano and crooning the hits of the day from a rotating stage. In her handwritten memories of that evening, she would say, "As the stage revolved, I looked at my watch, 10:15 p.m. Heard the bartender tell the 14-year-old busboy to put the bulb back in the tree as people wanted to be in the dark." That busboy, who was actually all of 16 years old, was Stanley Tomaszewski.
The New England Historical Society describes the scene. In a packed basement lounge, a serviceman and his date sat next to a fake palm tree with a 7.5-watt light bulb sticking out from a laminated coconut husk. The soldier reached over and unscrewed the light bulb so he could kiss his date in the dark. The bartender noticed and told Tomaszewski to go screw it back in. Tomaszewski climbed a bar stool but couldn't see much in the dark corner. He lit a match, held it in his right hand, and screwed in the light bulb with his left. Then he climbed down from the bar stool, dropped the match on the floor, and put it out with his foot. It was 10:15 p.m. Within 8 minutes, nearly 500 people would be dead or about to die. While many in Boston would blame young Stanley for the ensuing fire, the fire commissioner held him blameless in the final report. A busboy, aged 16, employed by the Coconut Grove on the night of the fire, testified to lighting a match in the process of replacing an electric light bulb in the corner of the Melody Lounge, where the fire started, and dropping the match to the floor and stepping upon it. After a careful study of all the evidence and an analysis of all the facts presented before me, I am unable to find the conduct of this boy was the cause of the fire. Some newspapers seem to have been nostalgic for Prohibition and blamed alcohol fumes for the fire. They claimed that the alcohol coming from people's breath and their glasses on the bar became concentrated enough to be an accelerant. However, a report from the National Fire Prevention Association contradicts this theory, saying, "It does not seem possible that there could have been sufficient alcohol vapor in the breath to have created a flammable mixture in the Melody Lounge. Evaporation from drinks on tables in sufficient quantity to furnish a flammable mixture is not theoretically possible."
The Coconut Grove Coalition identifies another possible cause of the fire, faulty wiring. Electrical work done in the Melody Lounge 3 years prior to the fire, and to the new Broadway Lounge in the 2 months prior, was done by Raymond Baer, a pipe fitter who was not licensed as an electrician. Baer was interviewed and admitted that he had performed electrical work in the Coconut Grove in October and November of 1942, installing electrical fixtures in the new Broadway Lounge. He also said that there was no permit issued for the electrical contracting. The fire commissioner's report would be inconclusive, saying, "I have investigated and carefully considered as possible causes of the fire the following suggested possibilities: alcoholic fumes, inflammable insecticides, motion picture film scraps, electrical wiring, gasoline or fuel oil fumes, refrigerant gases, and flame-proofing chemicals. There is no evidence before me to support a finding that any of these or any combination of them caused this fire. This fire will be entered into the records of this department as being of unknown origin." No matter the cause of the fire, the next 5 to 10 minutes were the deadliest moments in Boston history. And just as a side note here, we're going to be quoting extensively from the original Fire Commissioner's Report, a 1970 report in which Boston Fire Chief Fahey revisited the Coconut Grove fire, Goody Goodell's account, and the Globe's 35th anniversary retrospective.
The fire originated in the Melody Lounge. In my opinion, it started about 10:15 p.m. It was first seen burning in a palm tree and in the suspended false ceiling in the northwest corner of that room. This prelude to disaster progressed unnoticed for a moment. A few patrons viewed the curling flames as they danced through the satin layers above. The leaping fire was a source of comedy for some, and they laughed. The bartender squirted seltzer water at the flames, which provoked them to burn brighter. The room temperature increased considerably. Then, the leatherette wallboards and rattan burst into flames, and it was no laughing matter. Goody Goodell saw the flames immediately, writing, "My fingers froze on the piano keys. I kept saying, 'Don't panic, don't panic.' I was up and down on the bench. Fire caught on the tufted ceiling, and I ran from the piano to an opening in the bar to get out, grabbing the cashier behind me. She didn't want to leave the register. I told her, 'You can come back if they put it out.' We went into the kitchen, which I found 2 nights before. They were all busy. I told them the lounge was on fire. They thought I was pulling a joke." From this point on, the fire spread incredibly rapidly. The fire immediately spread throughout the Melody Lounge, along the underside of the false ceiling. It reached and ascended the stairway.
As soon as the flames began to spread, the electric lights failed, plunging the building into darkness. Hundreds of people jammed into the stairwell leading up from the underground Melody Lounge up to Piedmont Street. Meanwhile, Charlie and Betty Coombs had been celebrating Charlie's promotion that night. Just before the lights failed, Charlie and Betty edged their way towards the concealed corridor door, motivated by the busboy Stanley's nod to come over. 7 or 8 other patrons who had kept their heads were also looking around for possible escape, and they followed the barboy down the escape corridor into the kitchen. Stanley directed all of them into the larger of the two walk-in refrigerators. As the door closed, prayers were said by most in hope that eventually the firemen would rescue them. Those hoping to make it out onto Piedmont Street were doomed by King Solomon's cost-cutting measures of a decade earlier. A considerable number of deaths were caused by the fact that the door opening on Piedmont Street at the top of the stairway from the Melody Lounge could not be opened by persons who ascended the stairway from that room after the fire was first seen. Although this door was provided with a so-called panic lock, such installation was rendered useless by the existence of another lock which was found in a locked position. Flame appeared in the street floor lobby within 2 to 4 minutes after it was first seen in the basement room, and within 5 minutes entirely traversed the street floor of the main building and had passed to the entrance to the Broadway Lounge. As the fire rushed up the stairway leading from the Melody Lounge, it traveled near the ceiling and above the heads of persons ascending the stairs to make their way out of the building. Some of these persons later testified before me that they threw their coats over their heads to protect themselves against the fire as they ascended the stairway. When the flame appeared in the street floor lobby, it was described as traveling rapidly as a ball of fire below the ceiling. Many witnesses described the flame as of yellowish or bluish color.
Goody Goodell was among the people trying to find a way out of the first floor as the room burst into flames around her. We ran up behind the stage as a floor show was going on. Bartender was in front of us. I saw them pulling at the blackout curtains, tearing at them. A door was in between the windows. They tried to open the door, but it was locked inside. Couldn't make it. They tried with a huge 2x4, to no avail. Then, after the blackout curtains were down, I noticed iron bars going across. Almost hysterical, I kept saying, I'll never fit through those bars. Then I saw these people holding onto the bars feet first and sliding out. Jeanette the cashier went out ahead of me, then I was outside, falling on a pile of sand as they were using it for cement outside the new lounge in front. Jeanette went hysterical, saying, "If it wasn't for you, I'd be in there." Jackie Maver was a showgirl at the club, waiting in an upstairs dressing room for her cue to go on stage for her last set of the evening. She was supposed to go on at 10:15, and she wondered why they were running late. Charlie Michelonis, a waiter, burst into the room. "Girls, there's a bad fire downstairs," he cried. "You can't go down there now. It's too hot and the smoke is blinding." He ran across the room and said, "I'm going through this window to the adjoining roof. It's our only chance. Follow me, girls." Jackie insisted it was possible to make it down the stairs. They all grabbed hand towels and moistened them. With each girl putting her right hand on the shoulder of the girl ahead, Jackie opened the door. Heavy black smoke was creeping up the stairwell and the heat was almost unbearable. They descended the narrow staircase gingerly, each girl holding a moist towel to her nostrils, cupped with the left hand for partial breathing. Just 3 steps from the exit, Jackie glanced to the left and stiffened. The dining room was a holocaust. Patrons struggled in the semi-darkness, staggering into tables and falling over chairs. It was bedlam. Frenzied screams, shouts of frustration, crashing trays and shattering glass.
They were among the last to escape. Exits from the foyer were through the revolving door to the street, through the office coat rooms to the street, and this was obstructed by a coat rack and a lock, through the door to the street at the end of the corridor, previously mentioned as being locked, and through the other end of the lobby into the main dining room. Some few persons, including persons coming from the basement Melody Lounge, passed through the revolving doors on Piedmont Streets before the massive flames reached it. The door then appears to have jammed. There was a very great pouring of flames through the exit. The great majority of persons on the street floor had no warning of the fire until flames actually appeared in the lobby. Within 2 to 5 minutes of the first appearance of the fire, most of the possible exits, including all exits normally open to the public, were useless. Pouring a fire through such exits made it impossible for humans to pass simultaneously through these exits safely. In the course of such pouring, the mass of burning gaseous material appears to have been depressed from its high elevation within the premises in order to pass through these exits. The finding of bodies piled up at many of the exits is attributable to this fact.
At 10:15 p.m., the first fire alarm call came into the fire department headquarters. A truck responded and put out a small fire in a car at the corner of Broadway and Stewart Street. As they packed up to return to the station, firefighters noticed smoke coming from the nearby Coconut Grove and started in that direction. Some of the first fire companies to respond had to abandon their trucks and walk to the club because of cars that were parked blocking the corners of nearby blocks. Upon reaching the nightclub premises, rescue work was immediately begun by the firemen who had responded to the automobile fire. To facilitate this work, hose lines were introduced to reduce the intense heat. Shortly after the firemen gained entrance to the premises, the fire was controlled and the intense heat was abated. Firefighters Reggie Wise and Al Minahan used their axes to smash through glass blocks in the Broadway wall and get inside. In the main lobby, bodies that had been piled 8 feet high in front of the jammed revolving door were now laid out in neat rows on the sidewalk outside. In the main dining room in the caricature bar, many had suffocated from the toxic smoke so quickly that they didn't even have time to put down their drinks and stand up from their seats. One woman stood in the middle of the dance floor with a wool coat over her head. She was completely unharmed, but staring blankly as shock rendered her unable to speak. Reggie and Al approached the Melody Lounge stairwell. A spectral horror confronted them as the two men started to descend the stairs. Bodies were floating in 14 inches of water. Ashen-faced victims, many of them unscathed by fire, hung over bar stools and lay across tables. Going through a corridor, the firemen entered the kitchen, which had been untouched by fire. They opened the large refrigerator door and saw 8 bewildered and groggy patrons who had survived the 40 minutes of hell and the 38-degree temperature of their protective enclosure. In the end, 492 people would die, and at least 166 more were gravely injured, in a fire that lasted barely a half hour.
Injured victims were taken to Beth Israel, Boston City Hospital, Mount Auburn, Cambridge City Hospital, Kearney, Chelsea Naval Hospital, Faulkner, Massachusetts General, Massachusetts Memorial, Peter Bent Brigham, St. Elizabeth's, St. Margaret's, and U.S. Marine Hospital. The sudden influx of burn victims at local hospitals led to huge improvements in burn care, especially at Mass General Hospital. 2 surgeons there pioneered the fluid resuscitation method of treating burns. Large burns result in the loss of fluid from leaking capillaries, which can keep the heart from providing enough fluid and oxygen to the body's tissue. In fluid resuscitation, the burned areas are lightly wrapped with gauze and saturated in petroleum jelly to help stop fluid loss, while large volume IVs replace the fluid that has already been lost. At the time, penicillin was a barely known wonder drug, mostly reserved for use by the military. However, Merck delivered a supply of 32 liters to Mass General, where it was used to fight the staph infections that are common among burn victims and skin graft patients. The hospital's brand new blood bank was also pressed into action, allowing lost plasma and whole blood to be replaced. Every burn victim taken to Mass General survived, compared to only 30% of those taken to Boston City Hospital. Less than 2 weeks before the Coconut Grove fire, 6 Boston firefighters had been killed fighting a fire at Luongo's restaurant in East Boston's Maverick Square, where the building they were working in collapsed. And another huge fire broke out in the 5-story Salinger's department store in Downtown Crossing just over 2 weeks after the Coconut Grove. 600 firefighters and a contingent of Coast Guardsmen fought the fire for 10 hours. 65 people were hospitalized, but nobody died. After this season of fire, Christmas of 1942 was a grim holiday in Boston, and the city was ready to embrace improved safety and fire codes. The fire commissioner made a series of recommendations that would be adopted in Boston and would provide the basis for federal fire codes. Automatic sprinklers were required in any restaurant, nightclub, or place of entertainment. Basements were prohibited as places of assembly unless they had at least 2 direct fire exits with approved fire doors. Emergency exits were required to have panic locks, now known as crash bars, and no other locks. And all fire exits were required to have illuminated exit signs.
On December 1, 1942, the city of Boston closed 52 restaurants and nightclubs until their fire protection systems were inspected. Some clubs were able to reopen by December 5th. Others stayed closed for weeks or more, making renovations to meet the new safety standards. The legendary South End jazz club, the Savoy Cafe, would stay closed until July 8th of the next year, finally reopening in a new, larger location that conformed to the city's fire code. Some venues never recovered. Steinert Hall was a stunning auditorium built in 1896. It had ornate plaster, Corinthian columns, and impeccable acoustics. Unfortunately, it was constructed some 40 feet underground, under the Steinert Piano Company's headquarters on Boylston Street, across from Boston Common. It has sat empty and slowly crumbling since the city shut it down on December 1st, 1942. Club owner Barney Wolanski was convicted of multiple counts of willful manslaughter for the locked exit doors and other safety violations. He was sentenced to 12 to 15 years in prison and released after serving four. Busboy Stanley Tomaszewski endured death threats, insults, and ostracization for most of his life. He graduated from Boston College and worked for the federal government until he retired. By all accounts, he was a good and decent man. He often visited the graves of those who had died in the fire, but told reporters, "I don't have a sense of guilt because it wasn't my fault. If I felt guilty, I wouldn't be talking to you. My name would not be on the doorbell and in the telephone book. I never backed away." He died in 1994.
Today, urban renewal has altered the street girder on the site of the Coconut Grove, and much of the site is occupied by the Revere Hotel. In 1993, 51 years later, a small bronze plaque was placed in the sidewalk on Piedmont Street near the site of the jammed revolving door that claimed so many lives. It bears a floor plan of the club with the inscription, "The Coconut Grove, erected by the Bay Village Neighborhood Association, 1993. In memory of the more than 490 people who died in the Coconut Grove fire on November 28, 1942. As a result of that terrible tragedy, major changes were made in the fire codes and improvements in the treatment of burn victims, not only in Boston, but across the nation. Phoenix out of the ashes. In 2014, the plaque was removed while condos were built on Piedmont Street. And in 2016, it was replaced, but it was moved down the block to a point that was a parking lot in 1942, to be farther away from the entrance to the condos. Owner said, "We now occupy these homes with our families as part of the Bay Village neighborhood and would like to enjoy our homes in peace without tragic memories, hanging wreaths at our doors, or tourists peeking into our houses." Unfortunately, the most deadly single event in Boston history is memorialized by an 18-inch plaque in front of a former parking lot.
To learn more about the tragic fire at Boston's Coconut Grove, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/039. There will be plenty of pictures of the fire's aftermath. We'll have links to the four sources we quoted from so extensively, as well as more information on the jazz and nightclub scene in Boston back then. We'll have articles about the reopening of the Savoy Cafe and the potential future opening of Steinert Hall. We'll link to a Globe editorial about the current placement of the memorial and to the Coconut Grove Coalition, who keep the memories of the victims and survivors alive. And of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. And if you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show about Boston's Watch and Ward Society.